A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
So Daniel sent us this one, and it's not an abstract hypothetical. Right now, today, there are IDF soldiers at checkpoints on the Gaza border turning away Nisset members who are claiming parliamentary immunity to enter a closed military zone. The military declared the zone. The legislators say they're going anyway. That standoff is happening as we speak. Daniel's question is essentially this. When the army has to physically prevent legislators from crossing a line, hasn't it asserted itself as the ultimate authority? And if things have to get to that point, hasn't the rule of law already virtually collapsed?
That's the right framing, because what's happening at that checkpoint is not the crisis itself. It's the symptom of a crisis that's been accelerating since late June. Let's lay out exactly what got us here, because the sequence matters. In rapid succession, the outgoing Nisset passed four laws and then dissolved itself. Law 1 gutted the Attorney General's powers, removing the primary institutional check on executive action. Law 2 overhauled media regulation, giving the government direct control over licensing and content oversight. Law 3 made it a criminal offense to arrest ultra-Orthodox draft dodgers, effectively legalizing mass exemption, and then they shut the place down.
Dissolve the Nisset, which is a fascinating move strategically. You pass transformative laws that dismantle democratic architecture, and then you immediately close the legislative body so no one can undo them. It's like setting a fire and then boarding up the fire station.
And it's not subtle. The Times of Israel described the Attorney General law explicitly as removing a key check on government authority. That's not editorializing. That's the factual description of what the legislation does. Before this law, the Attorney General had independent prosecutorial authority and the power to challenge government actions legally. The new law transfers that oversight to political appointees. So the person who decides whether the government is acting legally is now someone the government appoints.
Which collapses the distinction between legal advice and political permission. The AG stops being a check and becomes a rubber stamp. And that's one of those institutional changes that doesn't look dramatic on the day it passes. No tanks in the streets. But it means the next time a prime minister wants to do something legally questionable, there's no one inside the system who can say no.
Right. And you see this pattern across what scholars call autocratic legalism. The forms of law are preserved. Everything passes through proper legislative procedure. But the substance of the law is to remove constraints on executive power. Hungary did this with the prosecutor's office under Orbán. It took years, but the mechanism was the same. Transfer appointment power, narrow jurisdiction, and suddenly an independent check becomes an instrument of the government.
The media law works the same way structurally. It's not state censorship in the old Soviet model, where a censor reads every article before publication. It's regulatory capture. The government gets control over licensing and content oversight. So a broadcaster that's critical of the government suddenly finds its license under review. The mechanism is indirect, but the effect is the same. You create an environment where compliance is safer than independence.
The Times of Israel called it laying the groundwork for a propaganda-like media environment, and that phrase is precise. It's not that every outlet becomes state media overnight. It's that the regulatory structure makes it increasingly difficult for independent journalism to function without risk. Licenses, content complaints, regulatory scrutiny, all of it can be deployed selectively.
And that's the thing about structural capture versus direct censorship. Direct censorship is obvious. It's a headline. Structural capture is boring. It's a regulatory hearing. It's a licensing delay. It's a content complaint that takes 18 months to resolve. By the time anyone notices the pattern, the media landscape has already shifted.
Now the third law is the one that's most directly connected to what's happening at the Gaza checkpoint today, and it's worth understanding the mechanism. The draft evasion law makes it a criminal offense to arrest ultra-Orthodox draft dodgers. Let that sit for a moment. The law doesn't just exempt them from service. It criminalizes the act of enforcing the existing law against them.
That's an important distinction. An exemption says you don't have to serve. This law says the state cannot even attempt to make you serve. And if a police officer tries, that officer is committing a crime. It's not a loophole. It's a legislative override of enforcement itself.
And this comes after the Supreme Court had repeatedly ruled that blanket exemptions were unconstitutional. The Nesset's response was not to negotiate a compromise or phase in changes. It was to pass a law that makes the court's ruling unenforceable. The Times of Israel noted that this was a direct legislative override of a Supreme Court decision. That's a constitutional confrontation, not a policy disagreement.
So you've got three laws passed in rapid succession. One removes the legal check on the executive. One captures the media oversight apparatus. One overrides the Supreme Court on a fundamental issue of equality before the law. And then the Knesset dissolves itself, so none of this can be rolled back. That's not a legislative session. That's a demolition project.
And the demolition is thorough because these laws don't just shift policy. They dismantle the separation of powers. In a functioning democracy, the executive is checked by an independent judiciary and an independent legal oversight apparatus, and the public is informed by an independent media. Those aren't accessories. They're the architecture. Remove them, and you have elections without democracy. You can vote, but the person who wins faces no institutional constraints.
Which brings us to today. The March on Gaza. Far-right politicians backed by Likud marching toward the strip with the stated purpose of what they're calling a return to Gaza, a reference to the 2005 disengagement. The IDF preemptively declared the Gaza periphery a closed military zone, making the marchers' presence illegal before they even arrive.
And this is where the institutional logic gets really interesting. The IDF is not making a political decision here. It's making a security decision under its operational authority. A mass march of civilians and politicians toward an active conflict zone into territory that is not under Israeli control would almost certainly trigger escalation. The military's job is to prevent that. So it used a standard security tool, the closed military zone designation, which it has the legal authority to do.
But the effect is that the military is now enforcing a boundary that the political echelon refuses to enforce. The government passed laws that dismantled the checks on its power, and now the military is stepping into the vacuum, not by choice, but because the security implications of the political action are so severe that the military has no choice but to act.
That's the paradox. The IDF is acting entirely within its legal authority. Closed military zones are a standard mechanism. They're used for training exercises, for security operations, for border control. There's nothing unusual about the tool. What's unusual is that it's being used against elected legislators who are claiming parliamentary immunity to enter the zone.
And that's the constitutional collision. Knesset members have parliamentary immunity. It's a fundamental principle of democratic governance. Legislators cannot be prevented from carrying out their duties. But the IDF's position is that security directives override parliamentary privilege in a designated military area. Who decides which claim wins? There's no obvious arbiter.
There isn't one, and that's precisely the point Daniel is getting at. The rule of law assumes a hierarchy of authority. The Constitution, or the basic laws, establish who has the final say in a dispute between institutions. But when the political branches have spent the last month dismantling the institutions that would normally adjudicate that dispute, there's no one left to decide. The Attorney General's office, which would normally provide a legal opinion, has been gutted. The Supreme Court can rule, but the government has just demonstrated it will override Supreme Court rulings with new legislation.
So you end up with two claims of authority, both grounded in law, and no institution that both sides recognize as legitimate to resolve the dispute. That's not a legal question anymore. That's a power question. And when it becomes a power question, the institution with the guns wins by default.
Not by choice, though. That's the distinction that matters. The IDF did not wake up this morning and decide to assert itself as the ultimate authority. It woke up to a security assessment that said a mass march into Gaza would get people killed and trigger a military escalation. It used the tools it has to prevent that. The fact that those tools now place it in direct confrontation with the Knesset is a consequence of the political situation, not a military decision.
But the structural logic is the same regardless of intent. When civilian institutions fail to check each other, the military becomes the de facto arbiter. We've seen this in other contexts. Turkey in 2016 was the most dramatic example, an actual attempted coup against Erdogan's creeping authoritarianism. This is not that. The IDF is not seizing power. It's enforcing a specific security directive. But the underlying dynamic is similar. The civilian checks have failed, and the military is the only institution left that can draw a boundary.
The comparison to Turkey is useful precisely because of the differences. The Turkish military saw itself for decades as the guardian of secular constitutional order. It intervened repeatedly, explicitly claiming that role. The IDF has never claimed that role. It has no democratic mandate to be a check on the Knesset. It's an institution designed to follow orders, not to interpret which orders are constitutional. That's what makes this moment so unstable. The IDF is being forced into a position it was never designed to occupy.
And there's another comparison that's instructive. The 2021 Capitol riot in the United States. In that case, legislators were the ones being protected from a mob. The National Guard was deployed to secure the Capitol so Congress could do its work. Here, the legislators are the ones being blocked. They're not being protected from a mob. They are the mob, or at least they're leading it. The military isn't securing the legislative process. It's preventing legislators from acting.
That inversion is striking. In a healthy democracy, the military protects the legislature so it can function. In this situation, the military is blocking legislators because their stated action would create a security catastrophe. The legislature has become the threat.
Let's sit with that word for a moment. Threat. The IDF's security assessment is that this march would trigger escalation. The march's stated purpose is to enter Gaza. Gaza is not Israeli territory. It's a conflict zone. A mass movement of civilians and politicians across that border is not a protest. It's an invasion. And the IDF's job is to prevent invasions, not facilitate them.
And that's why the closed military zone designation is so revealing. The IDF is treating this march the same way it would treat any other security threat to the border. The fact that the threat is coming from Israeli citizens and elected officials doesn't change the security calculus. A breach of the Gaza perimeter is a breach of the Gaza perimeter, regardless of who's doing it.
Which brings us back to Daniel's core question. Hasn't the rule of law already virtually collapsed if things have to get to this point? And I think the answer is yes, but with a crucial qualification. The rule of law hasn't collapsed in the sense of anarchy or chaos. The IDF is acting lawfully. The closed military zone is a legal mechanism. The soldiers at the checkpoint are following orders that are grounded in legal authority. But the rule of law has collapsed in a deeper sense. The laws themselves have become the instrument of democratic dismantling.
That's the distinction that's easy to miss in the headlines. We're not looking at a breakdown of order. We're looking at the use of legal procedures to destroy the legal order. The Knesset passed laws through proper legislative process. The IDF is enforcing security directives through proper military procedure. Everyone is following the rules, but the rules have been rewritten to eliminate the checks that made the system democratic.
And that's what scholars of democratic backsliding have been warning about for years. The coup doesn't come with tanks. It comes with legislation. It comes with regulatory appointments. It comes with laws that are technically valid, but substantively corrosive. By the time the tanks show up, the democracy is already gone. The tanks are just the cleanup crew.
What's happening at the Gaza checkpoint today is not the cleanup crew, it's the opposite. The military is using its legal authority to prevent an action that would be catastrophic. But the fact that it has to do this against elected officials means the political system has produced an outcome that the security apparatus cannot accommodate. That's a crack in the foundation.
Let's talk about what happens next, because the standoff today is not the end of this story. The Knesset members being turned away at the checkpoint are going to claim that the military is usurping civilian authority. They're going to frame this as a coup, or at least as military overreach, and they'll have a surface-level argument. In a democracy, the military does not tell legislators where they can and cannot go.
But the counter-argument is that legislators don't have the right to lead an invasion of a foreign territory. Parliamentary immunity doesn't cover marching into a conflict zone. The security directive is not a political statement. It's a military necessity. And that's the tension that has no resolution within the current institutional framework.
So here's the question that keeps me up at night. What happens if the Knesset passes a law tomorrow that explicitly orders the IDF to allow the march? Does the military obey? Or does it refuse? If it obeys, it facilitates an action that its own security assessment says would be catastrophic. If it refuses, it's explicitly defying the civilian government. Either outcome is a crisis.
And that's not a hypothetical. The same coalition that passed 4 laws dismantling democratic checks in a single week could absolutely pass a 5th law ordering the military to stand down. The legislative machinery is intact. The question is whether the military would treat such a law as a valid order or as an illegitimate use of legislative power to force a security breach.
That's the moment the crisis becomes acute. Not today's standoff, which is tense but legally manageable. The acute crisis comes when the political echelon orders the military to do something that the military's professional judgment says is disastrous, and the military has to choose between following orders and fulfilling its fundamental duty to protect the state.
And this connects to a broader pattern we've seen in other cases of democratic erosion. The military is often the last institutional check, not because it wants to be, but because it's the only institution that can't be legislated out of existence. You can gut the Attorney General's office. You can capture the media regulator. You can override the Supreme Court. But you can't pass a law that makes the military disappear. It's still there with its chain of command, its professional ethos, and its capacity to act.
The danger, of course, is that this creates a precedent where security logic overrides political logic. Today, the IDF is blocking a march into Gaza because the security assessment says it would trigger escalation. A future government could use that same mechanism for different purposes. Declare a closed military zone around a protest, around a polling station, around a court. The tool is neutral. The hand that wields it is not.
Which is why we have to be precise about what's happening here. This is not a military asserting itself as the guardian of democracy. This is a military using a standard security tool in a situation where the political system has produced an outcome that is incompatible with basic security. The IDF is not saving Israeli democracy, it's doing its job. The fact that doing its job now puts it in confrontation with the Knesset is an indictment of the Knesset, not a validation of military authority.
So where does this leave us? For observers of democratic backsliding anywhere, the Israel case is becoming a textbook example of autocratic legalism. The specific mechanism is legislative supremacy without constitutional constraints. Israel has no formal constitution. It has basic laws, and a Supreme Court that has historically interpreted them as constitutional principles. But if the Knesset can override any Supreme Court ruling with a simple majority vote, and if it can dissolve itself to prevent repeal, then there is no constitutional check at all. Legislative supremacy becomes absolute.
And absolute legislative supremacy in a parliamentary system without a codified constitution, without a Bill of Rights, without an independent upper house, without federalism, means that a simple majority can do anything. Anything. Including dismantling the democracy that gave it power.
That's the structural vulnerability that these 4 laws have exposed. Israel's democratic architecture was always more fragile than it looked, because it depended on norms and institutional restraint, rather than hard constitutional barriers. When the norms collapsed, there was nothing behind them.
The practical takeaway for listeners in other countries is to pay attention to the specific institutional checks in their own systems. Attorney General independence. Media regulatory bodies. The military chain of command and its relationship to civilian authority. These are the canaries in the coal mine. When you see legislation that transfers these functions to political appointees, that's not a policy debate. That's the early stage of institutional capture.
And the military question is the hardest one because, in a healthy democracy, you never want the military to be a political actor. The principle of civilian control is absolute. But what happens when the civilians are using their control to order actions that are catastrophic? What happens when following orders means facilitating the destruction of the state the military is sworn to protect? There's no clean answer.
There isn't. And that's why the standoff at the Gaza checkpoint today is so significant. It's not a coup. It's not a military intervention in politics. It's a security decision that has political implications the military never wanted and probably never anticipated. But the implications are real. When soldiers have to turn away legislators at a checkpoint, something fundamental has shifted.
The image is going to stick. Armed soldiers at a checkpoint, Knesset members demanding to pass, claiming immunity, being told no. That's not a normal political protest. That's not civil disobedience. That's two branches of the state in direct physical confrontation over who has the authority to determine what happens on the ground.
And the fact that the IDF felt it necessary to preemptively declare the zone closed tells you something about the security assessment. This wasn't a reactive measure. They didn't wait for the marchers to arrive and then decide what to do. They looked at the stated intentions of the march, assessed the likely consequences, and acted before the situation became unmanageable. That's professional military judgment, not political posturing.
The march's stated purpose is the return to Gaza. The 2005 disengagement. That's not a policy slogan. That's a call to reverse a territorial withdrawal through direct action. The implications of a mass civilian and political movement entering Gaza are not subtle. It would be seen as an invasion. It would trigger a military response. People would die.
And the political calculation behind the march is worth examining. The organizers know the IDF will block them. The standoff is the point. The images of soldiers preventing legislators from entering Gaza are the intended outcome. It creates a narrative of the military versus the people, the security establishment versus the elected representatives. It delegitimizes the IDF in the eyes of the marchers' supporters while simultaneously forcing the IDF to play the role of the heavy.
That's the trap. The IDF can't win this politically. If it blocks the march, it's accused of usurping civilian authority. If it allows the march, it facilitates a security catastrophe. The marchers have structured the situation so that any military response delegitimizes the military.
Which is why the rule of law question is so acute. The IDF is acting legally. The closed military zone is a valid mechanism. But the political context makes legal action look like political intervention. And when legal action and political intervention become indistinguishable, the rule of law is already eroding.
Let me try to synthesize what we've been circling around. The standoff at the Gaza checkpoint is a symptom, not the disease. The disease is the collapse of the separation of powers through legislative action. The four laws passed in late June dismantled the institutional checks that make democracy function. The Attorney General can no longer independently oversee the government. The media operates under government regulatory control. The Supreme Court's rulings on draft exemptions have been legislatively overridden, and the Knesset dissolved itself to lock all of this in place.
And when you remove those checks, you don't get authoritarianism overnight. You get a period where the institutions that remain are forced into roles they weren't designed for. The military becomes the de facto boundary enforcer not because it wants to be, but because it's the only institution left that can say no and make it stick.
That's not sustainable. The IDF has no democratic mandate to be a check on the Knesset. It's not designed for that role. It's not trained for it. Its officers are not elected. Its decisions are not subject to legislative oversight in the way political decisions are. A system where the military is the last line of defense against legislative overreach is a system that has already failed.
The next election, if it happens, will be a referendum not just on Netanyahu, but on whether Israel remains a liberal democracy. And the laws passed in June may be irreversible regardless of the outcome. You can't easily rebuild an independent attorney general's office. You can't easily restore media independence after regulatory capture. These institutions take decades to build and can be destroyed in a week.
That's the thing about democratic erosion. It's asymmetric. Tearing things down is fast. Building them back is slow, and it requires a consensus that may no longer exist. If a significant portion of the population believes the military is the enemy because it blocked a march into Gaza, you can't just pass a new law and fix that. The trust is gone.
And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1780s, a missionary in Tierra del Fuego recorded the last known speaker of a dual number in Slovene that had survived in isolation for two centuries. The grammatical form, used exclusively for pairs of seals, vanished when the speaker died in 1783. No other Slovene dialect ever developed this feature, and no one noticed it was gone for over 100 years.
A dual number just for pairs of seals. That is so specific, I don't know what to do with it.
The grammar of seal counting lost to history. Thanks, Hilbert.
But there's one question I keep coming back to, and it's the one that keeps me up at night. If the Knesset passes a law tomorrow explicitly ordering the IDF to allow the march, what happens? Does the military obey, or does it refuse? That's the moment this stops being a standoff and becomes something else entirely, and that moment is not hypothetical. It could come next week.
The fact that we can even ask that question seriously tells you where we are. In a healthy democracy, the question doesn't arise because the legislature doesn't order the military to facilitate an invasion. The laws and the norms prevent that scenario from ever materializing. Those norms are gone now. What's left is the raw question of who has the power to decide.
The standoff at the checkpoint is over for now, or it will be. But the boundary the IDF drew is not just a line in the sand. It's a line between two different ideas of what Israel is. One where the military follows orders from a legislature that has dismantled every check on its power, and one where the military says no. Neither version is a functioning liberal democracy. The question is, which version comes next?
Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. This has been My Weird Prompts. If you want to share your thoughts on this episode, email the show at show@myweirdprompts.com. We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.